for a small business such as mine, even though we had a registered trademark, we got tangled up by Computer Science Corporation, CSC at the time. Now, CSC was just a notoriously horrible company to get tangled in any way. They were known as the Rotten Company in the UK. They failed a number of projects in North Carolina. They were responsible for these rendition flights of torture, which was basically CIA planes that were being used and supplied by CSC to take people from the various salt pits and torture sites in Europe. And I don't know why a tech company would be in that business, but that's what they chose and that's what they did.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, just in time for Halloween, big tech horror stories. Thanks to our friends at EFF Austin, we present a session with author and tech veteran Vahid Razavi. He shares some of his personal experiences, many of them bad, from his time working for some well-known tech giants. He also shares the most important question to ask a hiring manager before accepting a job offer.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest virtual monthly installment of the EFF Austin Meetup. My name is Kevin Welch. I'm the current president of the board at EFF Austin. We also have another one of our board members here, David Hensley, tonight, as well as just various ones of our associates and fellow troublemakers. Without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker here. So actually, I'm very excited about this month's meetup because it represents something that EFF has been encouraging EFA members to do for a while, and this is the first time EFF Austin has done it, where we are having a speaker from another EFA member guest and do our monthly meetup. Vahid Razavi, I hope I'm saying your name right. Feel free to rudely correct me if I'm not. He is, I believe, a president of the board or whatever the equivalent position is at Ethics in Tech, which is a Bay Area-based member of the EFA. So, yes, just to give you a quick little introduction to our speaker, Vahid is a technology veteran of Silicon Valley. He's advised and worked in senior management roles at Amazon Web Services, Fast Search, Exodus Communications, Quest Communications, and he was the founder of the cloud computing company BizCloud. He's published two books, The Age of Nepotism and Ethics in Tech and Lack Thereof. As a lifelong activist and humanitarian, he has published hundreds of articles and videos on various social issues, including tech industry and social injustice. As the founder and managing director of Ethics and Technology, he's going to be chatting with us about some of the things he has learned over 20 years working in Silicon Valley. And obviously there's a big well of ethical questions to talk about there. And I was inspired to reach out to Vahid because we actually had an EFF meetup. He was making an interesting point about doing digital civil liberties outreach in faith-based communities, which all of us anarchist tech heathens were like, you know, that's a great idea. We don't even hang out in those spaces, but that's a great idea. So anyway, without further ado, I'm going to turn things over to Vahid here, and I look forward to hearing what he has to share with us.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Ethics in Tech started off our work in 2013 when Edward Snowden first came out with its revelations on blanket surveillance of Americans. And we started by doing what we know best, which was to educate the public by organizing events that brought in people that were sued, that sued the NSA, such as the Internet Archive, the people that, Cindy Cohen's, alongside people that worked for the NSA and for the security apparatus. And we combined it with comedians. We thought it would be a good thing to lighten the topic in order to present it to the audience by bringing in comedy and music into our events. And this was in 2013, where nobody really cared much about ethics and tech as much as they do now. We started our organization then, and we wanted to make sure that our board reflected the larger community. So from comedians to musicians to members of the clergy to a gentleman who worked 15 years at Google, we have a diverse board that represents us. And we're not funded by any company or any entity, except for one time or a couple of times we received funding from Stop Killer Robots campaigns. In terms of our partnerships, we don't have 50 partners. I would say we have three or four that matter. One is being, of course, EFA and the work that we're doing with the folks at EFF and its partners. We had an event a couple of weeks ago that included a number of Electronic Frontier Alliance partners, and including the Oakland Privacy, Portland Privacy, Stop out of New York. And, we try to build a community and to widen the discussion around the issues of not just privacy. In our case, it's broader than that. It's privacy, it's AI, autonomous weapons, income inequality that we see in the tech sector, the environmental impact of the tech companies and how some of them destroy the environment. So there's a lot of different issues that we want to address within ethics and tech. Unfortunately, we have limited resources. We're just a few people, but whatever we can address in our events and forums, we will. There's myself, a blog writer that is also a board member of Ethics in Tech by the name of Brett Wilkins, as well as a Christina Deptula, who is on the board and helps us with PR. And so for a small organization, we try to make a lot of noise. We'll go to a protest, bring our big signs and hang out and, with the EFA folks, if we can, against Apple or any company, and we don't have an issue in terms of being outspoken. And I spent the past 20 years, as Kevin mentioned, working in the tech sector. And I can tell you that, first and foremost, I'm no angel. I was in the rat race just like everybody else was, trying to succeed, I should say more of a horse race, trying to succeed in Silicon Valley. And I was in the sales and business development side. I started my career working at a retail computer store and worked my way up and selling Apples, and I think it was Mac Pros at the time, or I forgot, it was 1992, 93, 94, selling MacBooks and Apple products and working for a system integrator. I learned how to sell products really by working for Bay Networks, where I learned switching and routing and hubs and, got my career underway in terms of learning my sales skills. I got lucky, went to a very cool startup called Exodus Communications. They were the pioneers of the data center and co-location space. And I worked there for a couple of years, learned camaraderie and building sales teams and what it takes for good sales leadership from the executives there, and had a great experience. From then on, I started my own company called Something Now, Warranty Now. We sold extended warranties and service contracts, raised about $25 million. And that's when I learned that it's really not a good opportunity to raise money from media companies. The media companies will try to send you a bunch of media that you can't use as part of an investment deal, and you're better off going to investors that don't come with a bunch of media garbage and baggage trying to buy their products. I learned that lesson the hard way with Something Now. Unfortunately, the market collapsed in the dot-com bubble, and we were one of the victims of that and had to shut the business down. And that was disheartening, because you promised people and investors and employees a job, an opportunity, and it goes wrong. And it always impacts people. When companies go belly up, when shareholders have to hold the bag, it always impacts the people and employees that are in that company. And it had an impact on a few people that I was close to, and I still remember them. After working at my own firm, the Warranty Now, I went over to Quest Communications. I learned how big telcos operate, and how they skip out paying their sales reps in terms of commissions and bonuses, and compensating them. And I found out that the labor board doesn't really care about what happens with employees. You know, they're not going to go to bat for you in terms of being able to claim those comps. And then on, I went to a French software company, and I worked for Europeans. And I had an interesting experience. It was all good and well until... until they wanted to grow the business and they didn't find a place for me and wanted to get rid of me. And that happens in the tech sector. They owed me about $35,000 in compensation, which they didn't want to pay. I ended up taking him to court. They ended up settling for much more dollars than that. And one thing that we were learned in the process was that if you are an employee and you sue your employer, they can't come to you and say, hey, you have to pay our legal bills now if you lose. Because if you make it in a way that the legal bills are paid for by the prevailing party, then nobody would sue their employer because nobody could afford the lawsuit in terms of the legal bills and the lawyer fees. So that's one thing I learned at NeoCase. What I learned with FAST was that it was a pleasure to work with Norwegians. It's Europeans are incredible people to work with. They're smart, sophisticated, intelligent, yet, you know, humble. And it was a real pleasure to work with them. And I had a great experience till FAST got bought, acquired by Microsoft. And I decided in 2008 to start a company called BizCloud and hire a bunch of people in Belgrade, Serbia. So I built a team in Serbia, went back and forth a number of times to interview candidates, to work with them. And I think in my overall career, it was one of the biggest highlights of my life has been to be able to work with people that are abroad, that are different than myself, that believe in different religion, that come from a different background, and build camaraderie with them, build a working relationship with them, be able to work on a joint project together. And I made some amazingly good friends, some wonderful people that I came across, some great travel experiences to the Balkans. And I would always recommend anybody that's thinking about hiring folks abroad is to get on a plane, go and see them, get a chance to interact with them in person. And that's a wonderful way to build your team and build the community you want around your product and get people to buy into your vision. So definitely take the time to go out and see them. At BizCloud, one of the stories that's in my book is what happened in terms of trademarks and trademarks that I had. A trademark is a creator's way of distinguishing his work from everybody else. If, Coca-Cola or 24-hour fitness of the world can enforce their trademarks so nobody can compete with them. But for a small business such as mine, even though we had a registered trademark, we got tangled up by Computer Science Corporation, CSC at the time. Now, CSC was just a notoriously horrible company to get tangled in any way. They were known as the Rotten Company in the UK. They failed a number of projects in North Carolina. They were responsible for these rendition flights of torture, which was basically CIA planes that were being used and supplied by CSC to take people from the various salt pits and torture sites in Europe. And I don't know why a tech company would be in that business, but that's what they chose and that's what they did. So they also decided to pick up my trademark name of BizCloud. And, you know, for a number of years, we fought them. We sent them notices, told them to stop. And even though we had a U.S. trademark, they went to Europe and filed for a mark there and tried to back end of it and kick us out of our own mark. That basically, we had a lawsuit, and the lawsuit sent me in a tailspin because it made us force us to share our name with CSC. And I didn't want to have anything to do with CSC. And I frankly didn't want to have anything to do with BizCloud at that point. And I jumped off a perfectly good balcony trying to kill myself, and ended up breaking my back, my pelvis, my ankles, and being in a hospital for 4.5 months. And that's just the stress, you know, when you're involved with not just CSC, but, you know, the four of their partners in terms of a lawsuit. And you know that you can't buy justice like the way they can. Because at the end of the day, the justice system here in America is based on the number of experts you have. How many experts can you bring in into the courthouse? And those experts are usually, you know, university professors or people in the industry that charge $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to come in and testify. Well, a big company can afford an endless number of those, while the small guys would be lucky to get one or two experts to talk on their behalf. So I learned the hard way that really the justice system doesn't work for the little guy. The little guy has no representation fighting big tech. And came out of their broken back of the hospitals. And I decided, you know, people claim that we're not a cloud computing company or what have you. I had shut down BizCloud at that time. I said, you know, I'm going to go and work for the biggest, baddest cloud computing vendor there is, just to prove that, you know, I belong in this field. And I got a job working for Amazon as a senior alliance manager for big data and analytics. And in my first year of working at Amazon, I had four different managers. And at the same time, my partners that I managed that were assigned to me were big data partners, and they were very happy with my work. They awarded us, you know, Partner of the Year award. And that's with no manager above our heads telling us what to do. So a lot of the work that we did at Amazon was rewarding in terms of working with the with these partners. But the way we treated these partners was just not right. I remember once reInvent is coming up. We had a partner that had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in marketing with us. And they had made a request, their executives had made a request that we should take him out for dinner, their team out for dinner after a year of working with us. And Amazon executives at first said, yes, we'll do it. They gave me the task of finding the cheapest restaurant I can find in Las Vegas to accommodate my poor partner. And I found the cheapest restaurant, came back with, you know, what it would cost. I think it was $50, $60 a head for a Mexican restaurant. And then they came back and they said, no, we're going to cancel it. You know, we're not going to treat anybody out for a meal. And I thought, you know, here's a company that's making billions and billions of dollars, and it won't even take the smallest step in terms of, you know, treating its partners kindly. And that was just a, such a cheap move by AWS management. And, you know, it's not the frugality of Amazon. It's just being cheap as a company. It's just disgusting in some ways. And then the other part is like, frankly, partners of Amazon should not have their business models compared. You know, they should not be in a position where they have to know each other's business models is getting compared at Amazon while Amazon is coming up with competing products and services. So I think that's unfair to these partners. But, you know, Amazon is like a fire hose. If you are in the tech sector and you want to get customers, you're going to go to the top three vendors when it comes to cloud infrastructure, that being Amazon, Microsoft, or Google. And those are the ones that everybody wants to partner with at the end of the day. A guy like me who doesn't really like to work with any of them is going to probably stay out of a job for a long time because I don't want to go and work with Amazon. You know, people want to hire me and give me a job and say, go work with AWS. Well, I have no interest to do that. If I did, I would have figured out a way to kiss ass and stay at AWS. So anyways, that's my career up to this point in terms of what I've done. You know, one thing that I always end up asking hiring managers in my interview process, when they say, you know, do you have any questions for me? And maybe this is the reason why I don't get a job, is because I always ask them, you know, what kind of project are you willing to walk away from, Mr. Company X? You know, who are you going to say no to? You know, what was the last deal or contract you said no to that you thought was unethical? Because just because you're incorporated doesn't mean I need to do business with you. Just because, you know, you're building and working on the next technology for weapon system doesn't mean I need to do business with you. So if you, it's up to you to choose who you want to work for. So make a point of it to ask upfront, you know, what these companies represent by who they work for and what kind of projects they're willing to say no to. And that's how I evaluate tech companies, is based on them telling me no. What else I can share with you? The book Ethics in Tech came from my experience of working at Amazon and at the big tech companies. I thought what I saw was just despicable. I mean, what's going on in the tech industry is just disheartening these days. This is not the tech industry that I got into many, many years ago. It's what I call is greed learning. We are dealing with brute force machine learning and buying and selling stocks and in our Bitcoin tradings of the world. And we have underlying capitalism that doesn't care about the people. So it's capitalism combined with machine learning and producing greed learning. And what I see is, unfortunately, a lot of people can't participate in this system that we have created in the stock market, in the Bitcoin market. They don't have the ability. They don't have the ability to be able to play in the financial games. You know, if you think about the poor, the people that don't have enough money to survive, they're not going to be able to buy shares. They're not going to be able to make investments. And they're kind of excluded from the opportunities that the folks with the algorithms have. And we need a more equitable society. Because every day we're creating more and more poor people in this country while the billionaires enjoy the riches. San Francisco has got something like 67 billionaires, I believe, in the Bay Area in San Francisco alone. I don't know what the numbers are, but we're, you know, you guys are getting Elon Musk. So maybe you'll be able to smoke weed for legal. I don't know what's going to happen. But at the end of the day, these kinds of people scare me because they're so in it for their own greed. You know, they can't spend the money they have gained in their entire lifetime. And yet they need more. And they could do so much good with it. Unfortunately, they choose not to. So, you know, what do we do as activists? What is it that is going to bring us together and say we need to build a community to make sure our voices is heard, to make sure the voices of the poor is heard, make sure the voices of the people that don't have it, the people that get discriminated against are is heard. And I think we just need to focus on a strong community. And by a strong community, I mean different members of people that we don't usually collaborate with, people that we don't usually sit on the same table with. We need to expand our horizon and include them in our day-to-day activities and in terms of outreach, in terms of reaching to these communities and making sure that if tomorrow we need a base to call upon, that tomorrow we need to be able to organize a protest in front of an Apple store or in front of Facebook offices, or, you know, we need to do a protest online and sign a petition, that we can count on these activists, that we can count on these community participants to join us and to contribute. You know, our lives is enriched by the communities we built. And people say, you know, I was going to start with what do you want on your tombstone? Because I always think about, you know, people and what we all want on our, on the day we go from this earth. And it doesn't really matter, I guess, but, you know, always think about what I wanted on my tombstone. When I was a kid, I always thought I want to be a teacher, or I want to be known for telling people, you know, the truth. As I got older, I realized I want to be an activist. I want to be known for being an activist on my tombstone. I'm not an agitator or, you know, anything of that nature, but somebody who is contributing to society as an activist. And that's my goal in my life in terms of what I want to be able to achieve. And frankly, it would be nice to have a job again. I don't think anybody's going to hire me after the books I've written and after working in ethics and tech. But if, you know, actually somebody that would look at sales and business development people, would love to talk to them about it so I can get a job. That would be nice. But that's all I got. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I thought, I didn't know how long these sessions run. So I think you said a couple of hours, but let's open it
up. Up to. I always tell speakers they can talk as long as short as they want, with the asterisk that we technically usually book the room for about 2 hours. And I usually try to tell speakers, you start going much over an hour, it starts getting a bit draining on people. But I've had speakers who've used the full 2 hours and it was interesting for most of it. So if you're mostly getting to the point where you've said the main stuff you wanted to say, I mean, we certainly can go to Q&A mode immediately if you'd like, if you don't have any more.
Yeah, one last thing I was going to say is, as ethics and tech, we need some resources. You know, we could use some help in building our websites and making sure our sites stay secure and making sure that we make updates regularly. And we could use resources. So if you guys have resources in Austin that can help us in those kinds of endeavors, that would be greatly appreciated.
Certainly happy to do what we can. We also need a lot of the resources you mentioned, but we're happy to try to spread the wealth however we can.
Awesome.
And I'll just also say, you know, you could make a book out of your life story. It's crazy everything you've been through, but I want to thank you for, you know, it takes bravery to share everything you share for the cause. So I want to thank you for that.
Sure. No, it's just been some real life experience. I'm telling you, I'm no angel.
Well, I'm not either. But yeah, thank you so much. I mean, I now realize I'm just going to go down a rabbit hole reading about Computer Sciences Corporation, because apparently they used to be the biggest software maker in the United States in the 60s, and I know almost nothing about them. So I bet that will be an interesting rabbit hole. Does anyone have any questions? Yes, George.
I just wanted to say that it's interesting because I'm interviewing for jobs now, although I do have an activist position I might get. It's a little different, but that idea of asking what projects have you walked away from is brilliant. And I'm going to start doing that because, like, if someone doesn't have the right answer, you know, I really do want to work for an ethically good company. And that's a great question to kind of suss that out. So thank you for that.
And on that topic, I'll add a little thing on for, you know, I work at a startup myself as a senior software engineer. And one thing I'll say that is something you can look for, because working for an ethical employer is important to me, obviously, or I wouldn't be running this. Like, I've never worked for any of the FANG companies, you know, because it's, you know, even if your department is ethical, there, as Vahid, you know, correctly points out, your department may be ethical, but the thing is a behemoth, you know, other departments may not be so ethical. But one thing you can look for is how your startup or the company you're thinking of working for is structured corporately. Particularly, you can look for something called a public benefit corporation or a PBC. What's cool about this legal structure is, unlike most incorporated companies who have a fiduciary duty to the shareholders, the board, to maximize profit no matter what, with ethics not being in the conversation, a public benefit corporation, the board can actually tell the shareholders, we're not going to do the thing that leads to maximum product because it goes against the mission statement of the company, and they won't get sued for violating fiduciary duty if they're set up with that structure. So something to look for if it is something that matters to you. My company is registered as a PBC.
Yeah, we're registered as a 501c3.
That's a common pure PBC is more if you're looking a for-profit place to work that you want a little more ethical safeguards than your average company. I'm not saying that they can't, like any other company, make unethical decisions, but it just means that they legally have the right to make ethical decisions, which in America, weirdly, most companies don't actually have the legal right to do the ethical thing if it will lose money.
And I would guess that most companies that structure themselves that way do it because they care about it.
Yeah, like my company is literally our mission statement. You know, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing if we didn't care. And I guess one other thing, this is rarer than finding PBCs, but you can also look into worker cooperative-based companies. They tend to have much more direct stake from the employees in what they do. They're fairly rare in the tech industry, though there actually is one here in Austin called Polycot Associates that one of our board members was a co-founder of, though he is retired from there now. So there definitely are ways to find a way to put your skills in tech to gainful employment, but try to hold true to your ethics. Do we have other questions? I certainly could ask a few questions, but I want to make sure we get questions from everybody else. So, you can either message me a question or you can raise your hand and I'd be happy to unmute you. You can ask it directly. And it's also fine if people don't have too many questions. I certainly can ask a few questions if people are mostly cool. I'm also being asked to plug a Austin-based organization who are pretty cool called Tech Workers Coalition. They are Austin Tech Workers Coalition. They're a coalition of workers in and around the tech industry, labor organizers, community organizers, and friends. Yes, Tech Workers Coalition here in Austin are awesome people. My friend Aslan does quite a bit of work with them. But they're particularly if, like, the fact that there are no unions in the tech industry is an important issue to you, they're the people you should get talking with. good call out there. Let me think.
There's some concerns that we have, that we should probably talk about. The whole idea of this deep fake that 60 Minutes just did segment on this week.
Actually, that might be an interesting question because, you know, you work for Amazon. They use a lot of these machine learning technologies and various things. I think any people like us who work in tech we both are less terrified of the tech than ordinary people because we know the magical stuff it can't do that some ordinary people think it can do. But we're also still quite terrified because what it can do, especially once it's scaled up, is pretty scary, actually. Like, what do you think we can do about the problem, if anything? Like, I mean, how do we actually get these companies to have ethical safeguards on deploying these systems?
At the end of the day, I just think that we need to have regulations. And that the only thing that they're afraid of is two things: how it impacts their investors and how it impacts their PR. And if we can make an impact on those two plus regulations, you know, from activist perspective, reach out to investors, know their business practices, tell them not to invest in these companies unless they change X, Y, and Z. And from a PR perspective, go after them when they launch a new product, when they have a new product offering. You know, let's go to Las Vegas for reInvent, but let's be outside passing out flyers and connecting with people via vocal horns, as well as, you know, buying ads on Googles of the world to make sure people see our content. If we need to, you know, talk against Amazon's business practices. I think those kinds of things are very effective. You know, well, one thing we did, for example, that I know really pissed off CSC was when VMworld had conferences here in Moscone Center. You know, we had protesters from Occupy that came out and protested against CSC during the lunch hour, during the conferences. And that's what they care about, is their PR, their image. So if you can hurt their image, or if you can reach out to their investors to say not to invest in these companies, you have done a huge milestone in terms of service.
It looks like,
you go ahead, George.
Oh, I was just going to say, it looks like Facebook has done that to themselves, basically. And, you know, we'll see the outcome of that. But the accusations, which are well documented, are super serious. So that's where there's a possibility that coming out could possibly lead to new regulations on it.
Yeah, but you know what? It's going to take us a whole collective to make sure that these news pieces stay in the headlines. We have a tendency to forget in this country. You know, a war happened. Oh, 2 weeks later, we forget about it. You know, COVID breaks out and we get our cures, and 6 months from now, we're going to be all, you know, forgetting about what happened. I just think that, you know, I hope we don't. I hope we have a more longer memory.
That actually, yeah, gets to an interesting question I would have in general, which is like, yeah, how do, you know, we people who really care about these issues, we tend to stay engaged on them and follow them even when the news cycle leaves them. But like, how do we keep the sustained pressure up when the news cycle starts moving? Because I even think here in Austin is a good example. This isn't directly related to EFF's Austin's work, but it sort of tangentially crosses over. But I personally was somewhat involved in some of the Black Lives Matter protests that happened, not this summer, but the summer before. I specifically was one of many people who called into city council about the police brutality against the protesters. Apparently, I made a very good case because I was actually contacted by the local news afterwards to be a talking head about the issue for the evening news. And no coincidence, I saw a couple of police cars parked outside my house the evening that aired, actually. So I'm sure that was a coincidence. But the thing was, is that so there was anger when the police like injured these activists, some of them like life-threatening injuries. And like there were literally 300 people who called into the Zoom council meeting screaming like, you know, fire the police chief, fire the city manager, fire any council member who won't fire them. And everybody was so up in arms. And yet here it is a year later, and most of these people never got fired, never really got held accountable because the public forgot about it and moved on. And now only the really hardcore activists care anymore. There's not that public rage coming for their heads anymore. And I'm just, so I think you really, it's exactly there. Like, these tech companies, they ride out their latest scandal. They never actually change anything. What do you have thoughts on, like, ways we can break that narrative?
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of being persistent. You have to be out persisting your enemies, and you have to look at different ways of being able to get the news out. You know, who are your advocates? Who are your organizations that are like-minded? In our case, organizations like Code Pink are like-minded. Stop Killer Robots campaign is like-minded. You know, they work at national level. We work at a local level. But, you know, we can bounce off of each other and work on ideas and get it out there in terms of being able to continue with public support. Otherwise, people lose interest. 2 months later, 6 months later, they forgot about it and they've moved on. Well, you know, that injustice has never been fixed.
Yeah, we got a couple of questions that I asked here, so I'm going to first unmute Singiz here.
Oh, hi. I just watched this YouTube clip of TED Talk yesterday. I think it was online change is hard to organize. And it was giving an example of black activists back in the day when they were going big, and it was pre-internet. And the TED Talker was saying that part of the reason the movement was had teeth or was able to make change was because the activists kept going through trials. They had to like sneak into dormitories and start mass printing leaflets. And that required great logistics and great coordination. And it made sure that the people were completely on board and engaged with what they were doing. And that's what gave them teeth and got the legislators, you know, moving, was because there was this constant push and constant activity that was going on in the background. So when you saw images of all these protesters in the streets for the Black Lives Movement, legislators were scared because these people were active. And when you get online movements, you have people who show up instantly for the day because they saw the hashtag and they ran to the streets. They don't have the trial and the push that's going on. And when you see movements like politicians getting into power, part of the reason that there's this huge push that's putting them in power was because they've been working for months on building up the people. And so to have the sustainment, I think we need to build from the ground up, if that makes sense, rather than have the movement on the day. And yep. So what you were saying with the police is that people were angry in the moment, but they didn't have the connections. They didn't have the small groups of where to go for their leader. And they didn't have like the committees to keep everyone activated and going to sustain the movement. And that's why people are like, they were there in the streets for like 2 minutes and then they're gone the next day because these people, sure, they were angry, but they don't know where to go next. And they don't know how to, they don't have the people around them to build the fire, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so they don't seem such a big threat.
Yeah.
So,
but you know what, try to build it in the communities of tech workers. You know, all these campuses that they have built for tech workers are so locked down. It's like they live in a world of their own while there's an outside world that operates outside of their community. You know, you go down to Google campus or you go to Apple's campus. It's not inviting for an average Joe to walk on that campus and interact with tech workers, which makes it challenging in a way. You know, how to interact with people that spend, you know, 60 hours a week working and living in their own community where they have their own dry cleaner and laundry and food. And
you know, if I didn't know any better, I would almost think this might have something to do with why the big tech companies are so desperate to get their employees back in the office. Because if they're no longer in that enclosed campus environment, well, suddenly they're not cut off from the real world anymore now, are they? Just a thought. We got a question here from Carl.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, surveillance, you know, on a, I guess on a macro level, especially by the government and police, but I'm thinking more like on a micro level. Because recently I've been like really close at getting some jobs. They really liked my resume on Indeed or LinkedIn. And then all of a sudden, I'm not a fit. So I'm thinking what's happening is I look good initially, but then once I make it, you know, to a certain point, they say, well, let me Google this guy.
And,
he's hanging out with Kevin and blah, 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 blah.
I would hope I'm not terrible for one's employment, but I think to Carl's point that it's like, yeah, Carl is a very involved activist here in Austin. And, you know, he's opinionated in his beliefs, you know. That's an interesting question. You know, we paranoid tech types tend to definitely, you know, be like, you know, we both under and overplay how much these companies know about us. But like, I mean, like a company like Amazon, like if you're applying there, like how big a deep dive on your web presence do they do on you when they're thinking about hiring you? Do you have any insight into that?
I think it took them 3 weeks to run my background check. So, you know, and the fact is companies on the background checking could include all sorts of information from your credit history to, you know, companies you worked for. And of course, it could be a check that's not really with your permission going behind your back and talking to people that you worked with and getting their feedback on you. And they could do that just as well. You know, you're giving them permission to do a reference check.
Will a company like Amazon, is it for like big tech things like that? Is it like a red flag if they notice a potential employer has a history of tech activism and being a troublemaker and caring that the product's being used ethically and not just maximizing profits? Like, have you seen them go like, we don't want to hire this person, they're going to be trouble?
I haven't, but I mean, I'm sure that exists. At the end of the day, Amazon is in the business of hiring people that fits its mold, that they can have buy off on its leadership principles and follow Jeff Bezos' dogma. And that's what they want. You know, when people like me that speak up, are not welcomed in an organization like that.
Well, one thing that people can do if you're not you're an activist but not a leader like you are, is sock puppet accounts. You know, you can at least keep your identity away from your social media presence when you're doing that kind of work. I've had those in the past.
Well, and certainly I would definitely recommend that. Yeah, I mean, you know, you definitely want to be careful with, you know, as I always, you know, I've had people over the years who have sometimes asked me things of borderline legality, and always the first thing I tell those people is, well, regardless of whether I agree or disagree with particularly what you're thinking of doing, we should not be having this conversation in Facebook Messenger, you know, do it on Signal, you know, exactly. And so, but yes, I mean, certainly, you know, depending on your risk profile, I mean, yeah, you know, I tend to be pretty outspoken in my beliefs. So I just tend, and I have such a known presence at this point as an activist that I don't know if I could really fix my reputation with sock puppet accounts, but certainly at the same time, yeah, you know, managing your online identity and your accounts, depending on what you're doing. And if you worry about big tech caring about it, it's a tactic. It's something to consider. I got a question here that was asked in the chat. So I had a question, and it sort of ties into something that was already said here, but like, in your opinion, Vahid, what can the average person do to get involved with these sorts of ethical issues and make a difference? What if you're not even a tech worker, much less an industry leader?
What I would do is get involved with the various organizations, find out when they have events.
You mean like EFF Austin or Ethics and Tech?
Exactly. Find out. Come to our event. You know, our event has got comedy in it. It's got poetry in it. It's got, you know, big tech speakers, but it's a variety of discussions, and we try to make it entertaining and fun, so you get an education and you get to be entertained at the same time. Check out the online petitions against some of these companies. See what's going on in terms of the concerns that people have on, you know, change.org or Roots Action against big tech. You know, go and sign on these petitions for various congressmen for them to hear your views. Get educated. At the end of the day, everybody has an interest, you know, just like people, I have an interest to know about pharmaceutical industry all of a sudden. You know, shit happens in this world that is going to say, you know, Facebook is harmful to kids. Facebook is a danger to kids. And you need to be educated to protect your kids. You know, that's your duty in this society. You can't pass the buck. You know, nobody else can go out and do that for you. But pick a few organizations, let them lead, let them, you know, tell you what petitions to sign, what events to attend, you know, but, you know, go and do your selection of the orgs first and then dive deeper with each and see how you can get involved with each. We need the voices now more than ever. And the tech lobbyists, I mean, it's a scary world. You know, they spend millions and millions and millions of dollars buying politicians. And of course, the politicians respond in kind and look the other way. So, you know, we don't have that kind of lobbying power, but we can definitely have a voice if we are united.
And you know, I'll just add on that. You know, I think that's right. You know, and I'll give my own just thoughts on that question real quick. Where I'll say, you know, eventually, if you care about the issue, it's your own responsibility to get educated on the issue and become informed. When I started caring about this stuff, you know, a little over a decade ago, I didn't know very much about a lot of these topics, and I have gotten pretty informed on them as I've done my activism. That being said, it's absolutely a good idea to pick a few orgs in this space you trust, and you start getting your own sense of what you believe on these issues as you gain the nuance to understand them and argue effectively. EFF is obviously a great one to follow. Fight for the Future is another good one, especially if you care about crowdsourced activist petitions and actions. Fight for the Future is usually really good at getting big visibility on an issue quickly. They, along with EFF, were one of the main people behind the Sober Piper protests a decade ago. That was one of the first major successful examples of mass internet activism. And, you know, a lot of it really, and, you know, I think we keep dancing around this, but I will say that a lot of it is, I think, about creating and sustaining a sense of community, you know, like as we were talking about, you know, that you don't just show up when there's an emergency, that there's that constant level of being ready, you know, and that comes from a community, you know, like I always like to joke, like, you know, yeah, I intentionally play up that haha, we're a bunch of cyberpunks. And I'm doing that, you know, very tactically because, hey, that's fun. You know, it's rebellious. It's cool. It's got good marketing and image, you know, and I'm not just, you know, I'm doing that because, yes, I enjoy cyberpunk literature and stuff, but it's intentional, too. It creates a sense of community. And this is something that I think you can consciously choose to do with your own activist community. Cultivate that sense of community. Let's see. I got a couple questions here. First, I guess I'll go with George there. And then I think Singhas has her hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, I saw an interview recently. Trevor Noah on The Daily Show interviewed Greta Thunberg, and it was out, you know, the relevance here is he asked her the question, what can an individual do? And her answer was very similar to what you just said, get informed. And but her take on it was, if, you know, once you get informed, if you're sufficiently informed, you'll figure out what to do. And I thought that was good advice. And it was only a couple of weeks ago. It's Trevor Noah. I would advise watching it in addition to, it was an awesome interview and her sense of humor came across. It was really cool. She's awesome.
But the alt-right part of the internet told me she's humorless and terrible. That doesn't make any sense.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Let's see. Singhas, you have a question?
Yeah, I was just thinking that in this, I guess, activism industry, a lot of the people who are involved of it seem to be like people who know about law and people who know about tech. And for the common layperson, I don't know much about technology and I don't know much about law. It's very complicated speech, if that you could say. And there's a lot of technical terms and you got to convey it to people what's going on and simplify the issue. So that the people who are not talking about tech, the people who are not talking about law, because I don't know about you, but law is kind of boring for a lot of people. And so is technical terms that I don't know much about. And yes, we've got to get into it and educate ourselves, but we've got to break it down and simplify these very complex issues so people can get on board and put it, I guess, storyteller. Because when we don't know about something, we tell stories. And that's kind of what we need to do. We need to find ways of explaining stuff in a way that's engaging. Like you were mentioning comedians that you brought in to talk about issues, because that's a lighthearted way of getting people involved. So yeah, it's creating media, creating art, creating it makes it seem kind of hit to get people in.
I really appreciate everyone's time. Thank you so much for hearing us out. You know, you're invited to our events. You're invited to anything that we put together, any support that you need for any initiative that you got going, please feel free to email me. I'm at your disposal. I'll put my email address in the chat session, and would love to work with you any way that you think is appropriate and can be supportive.
Well, thank you so much, Vahid. I really do think a lot of the future success of the movement depends on EFA members collaborating more and more. So yes, I will be in touch. And thank you so much for your talk. I think it stimulated an important, interesting discussion.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.